Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into several aspects of the shooting in Arizona that claimed six lives and critically wounded Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who remains in intensive care. We'll begin with Mary Rose Wilcox, who is District 5 supervisor in Maricopa County. She was shot in 1999 by a man upset by one of her votes, who admitted at his trial that he was motivated to shoot her because of hate-filled rants against her vote on right-wing talk radio. We will discuss with her and then Dan Gibson, a reporter with the Tucson Weekly, the climate of hate in Arizona, where lax gun laws and polarized politics have led to a deadly brew that the Pima County Sheriff Clarence Dupnik has criticized, making the state of Arizona, in his words, the mecca for prejudice and bigotry. Then we will further analyze the influence of right-wing hate groups on the politics of Arizona and the extent to which they have contributed to the violence as opposed to being responsible for it. Mark Potok, the spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor of its award-winning quarterly investigative journal Intelligence Report and the Hate Watch blog, joins us. Then finally, we'll look into the foreign policy implications from the latest shooting outrage and massacre of innocent civilians that is unfortunately happening all too often and becoming routine in the United States. We will speak with David Rothkopf, who has an article in Foreign Policy titled, How Can a Gun-Crazed Society Lead the World? I'm speaking with Mary Rose Wilcox, who is District 5 Supervisor of Maricopa County, Arizona. She is the first Hispanic woman to serve on both the Phoenix City Council and the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. She is serving her fourth term on what has been called the best-run county by Governing Magazine and Syracuse University. In 1997, she was shot by a man upset by one of her votes as she left a board meeting. So I imagine, Mary Rose Wilcox, the shooting of the congresswoman down there must have hit you pretty hard, having experienced the same thing yourself.
Yes, it really did. I was very moved by what happened, you know, very disturbed by it. I think all of Arizona was very upset. Gabby Gifford is a well-beloved legislator here, a congresswoman, and we just couldn't believe it could happen, and not only to Gabby, but to all of the people who got shot, those who survived, and those who got killed.
And in your case, it was somebody that was mad at you about your support for a baseball stadium tax?
Yes, what occurred is Maricopa County Board of Supervisors got authority from our state to vote in a baseball tax for the Arizona Diamondbacks, who were not even created then, but an expansion team was looked at. If we voted the stadium, we could get the expansion team. You know, the legislature was supporting it. The talk radio programs at that time came out opposing it, saying that we had no right to tax. And the gentleman who shot me and has served a long time in prison because of it, at the trial, basically said he had been listening to the radio saying that I should be taken out because of it. So he decided to take me out.
And this is the same radio that is still broadcasting. And there, I take it that a lot of the local disc jockeys who have been aggressive towards both you and the congresswoman and in support of Tea Party members are now on the defensive and suggesting that the shooter down there is a left winger or a nutcase or whatever. But nobody seems to be heeding the advice of the Pima County Sheriff Clarence Dupnik, who's calling for a timeout from all of this poisonous rhetoric.
Well, I think here in Arizona, we're very hopeful that people will heed it. I know some of the talk radio shows and some of the blogs, it's discouraging because exactly what you said, they're saying this is a lone incident. It was a man who was deranged. You know, we shouldn't tie it in, but you have to tie it in. There's a climate of hate here in Arizona because of immigration, because of health reform, and we're feeling it. We felt it for about the last 2.5 years. We need to get back to civility in political discussions, and I think the radio stations who are saying it's a lone incident, they are wrong. A climate has been created here that I think has caused this to happen, and we have to change that.
But it would seem that there's more than a climate of toxic political discourse. There's also the availability of weapons. Is there any kind of, and again, the Pima County Sheriff did talk about the gun laws and the need for citizens of Arizona and of the United States to reflect on these things. He was complaining, for example, that the ability for this assassin to carry a concealed weapon without a permit was only part of a broader problem. Now, apparently, Senator Russell Pierce, who's supposedly a very powerful political figure in your state, wants to extend these gun laws further. And the sheriff was complaining, saying they want to allow students and teachers at schools to carry guns.
Well, you're right, and that's going to be a big test. We've seen what happens because of our very, very liberal gun laws. The gentleman or the young man who shot Gabby Gifford and all of the people in Tucson had bought his gun with no background check at all. He bought a 9mm Glock. And I think our laws need to be changed. When these laws came through last year that allowed people to carry concealed weapons with no permits, the police officials came out entirely opposed to it, from Sheriff Dubnyk to all our police chiefs in Phoenix and Tucson, and the legislature did not heed them. A big test will come in Arizona in about a week. Two laws are going to be introduced at the state legislature that do, as you say, allow professors and faculty, but also students, to carry concealed weapons on campus. That is going to be a big test, whether those laws will go through or not. I was at the opening of the Arizona State Legislature today, and everybody was talking about needing to tone down this violence. So I'm hoping that those bills do not pass.
But at this point, you can carry a concealed weapon into a bar.
Yes, you can.
And does anybody, I mean, when did that pass? Was there a debate? One would obviously be able to make the point that, you know, drunk and people, and sometimes you get into fistfights in bars. It just seems to be so counterintuitive to add weapons
really
to the mix.
And those of us who oppose them fought very hard. And as I said, almost without exception, except possibly for our sheriff in Maricopa, the law enforcement community comes out opposed to these. I think we've all learned if law enforcement is going to be against something, if we're going to combat these gun laws, it has to be a unified voice. Business community, the education community, the everyday citizen is going to have to scream about it. One of the things that's happened in Arizona is we have term limits. So you have people who really don't have the allegiance to their constituencies that maybe past legislators did. They're there only for a short time because of term limits, and they're not listening to constituents. We need to bring that up. I also believe that what will come up this year that is going to be a test for Arizona is the changes to the 14th Amendment. You know, we're a border state. We have people who want to introduce an, bills that will basically make it illegal for undocumented people to have children in Arizona and to be given a birth certificate, a United States birth certificate. That is a major federal issue. We have no business discussing it in our state and causing divisiveness again. The immigration bill 1070 caused hate like you wouldn't believe. You know, I am a United States citizen, fourth generation Mexican American, and when I was going to sometimes rallies, sometimes meetings, I had people yelling at me, "Go back to Mexico, you're un-American," and a lot of other bad things. This has to stop. We've got to ratchet it down. But you're right. Here in Arizona, it's very hard with what the legislature have passed. I'm hoping that this shooting that occurred, very tragic shooting, serves as a red flag and that we all take notice and stop putting forth these bills.
Again, let me remind the audience, I'm speaking with Mary Rose Wilcox, who is District 5 Supervisor of Maricopa County in Arizona. She's the first Hispanic woman to serve on both the Phoenix City Council and the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors. She is serving her fourth term. And I take it, though, you mentioned in passing the Maricopa County Sheriff. He's quite famous or infamous, depending upon your point of view, Joe Arpaio. He, I take it, is also a very close ally of arguably the most powerful politician in the state of Arizona, Senator Russell Pierce. Am I right?
Yes, you are right.
So the governor, where would you rate her in terms of power? I mean, doesn't Pierce and his colleagues have a two-thirds majority, and they don't, even if the governor was not inclined, they could override her veto?
Well, I think the governor will be tested this year. This is her first full year as an elected official, and she did sign Senate Bill 1070, you know, the immigration bill that is now being fought in the courts. So I think the gun control, the 14th Amendment, she will be tested. I know our business community is trying to come together, trying to coordinate efforts to stop these bills because of the economic loss for Arizona, because Arizona is being hurt, our image is hurt, the economy is in the tank, and we must stop Arizona from being known as just a hate capital of the world and these crazy bills coming forward. The governor has power if she exerts herself. I think if she coalesces the business community and there's support shown, all of these people, you know, support legislators at one time or another, they have to start speaking up and say, no, we will not support you if you put forth legislation such as this. It's very hard. And as you say, Sherpa Pyle and Russell Pierce have amassed a lot of power, but I'm hoping it's power that will disintegrate once the hurt is shown that some of their efforts have put forth. I'm not blaming them for what happened in Tucson, but I think the environment that they've helped create with the bills that they put forward and the immigration raids need to stop. And I hope they're aware of that. But more importantly, I hope Arizona wakes up, particularly our business community, who can have a lot of influence at the legislature.
And what is the climate there in terms of extremist groups? Because I was talking yesterday to a reporter in Tucson, a local reporter, who said that Russell Pierce had been at meetings where spokespeople from racist radical groups, not the Minutemen, who are fairly well established, although they are, I think, by many definitions, an extremist group. But yeah, we're talking about neo-Nazis, people who have demonstrated ties to extremist groups. And following you, we'll be talking to the spokesperson for the Southern Poverty Law Center to analyze this phenomenon.
Yeah, and that's very worrisome. Russell has been linked to those groups. There have been YouTube showing him with those groups, and he's denied any link with them. But you can't help but think, why would you be with them? Why would you coalesce with them? The man that wrote 1070, who claims credit for that, Chris Kovac, we're very worried about his relations. What is Russell's relationship with him? So there's a lot of fear here. I do think that people need to stand up. And in Arizona, there's a climate of fear, not only in the immigrant community because of immigration, but of other people. The sheriff has investigated people who did not believe in his stance, and that kind of investigation scared people. But little by little, we're coming out of that. We are now having federal government come in. They've intervened in 1070. They're trying to stop it. We've had them come in to investigate abuses of power. We're hoping those cases come to fruition and people are stopped from doing the evil that they're putting forth. I think, what happened in Tucson, and Gabby Gifford is a symbol of somebody who was an excellent public service, and because of being demonized, because of the rhetoric and the hate, a deranged person, you know, tried to take her out. I really think that will have an effect. We have good people here in Arizona. We have people like Sandra Day O'Connor. We have people, you know, who are all of a sudden saying, wait, let's take a step back. You know, the support for the victims has been tremendous in our state. This was an eye-opener as never before and a tragic, tragic one. We cannot afford to have this happen over and over. And it will if we don't stop these hate bills from going through.
Well, just in closing, to get a clarification, Mary Rose Wilcox, who is the person that you said helped write SB 1070 and has been associated with Russell Pierce? And he's an extremist, but Russell Pierce has tried to distance himself from this person.
Chris Kovac.
Chris, what organization does he belong to?
You know, I'm not sure, but he has been known to be behind many of the anti-immigration bills that are being written. He just got elected to Secretary of State in Kansas, but he has been known to be kind of the driving force. But you know, I don't, you know, he was asked to come in. It's people like Russell Pierce and Sheriff Joe Arpaio that we have to have listen to reason. They are elected officials. They have to be responsible elected officials. But it's incumbent on all of Arizona to take what happened and use it as a teaching experience and stop what's happening here in Arizona from occurring again.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Mary Rose Wilcox.
Thank you, Ann.
And I'm, again, Ian Masters, and I'm just speaking there with Mary Rose Wilcox, and I'm now speaking with Dan Gibson, who's a reporter for the Tucson Weekly. Dan, just to follow on from what Mary Rose Wilcox was saying about this fellow Chris Kobach, is he significant? Because, you know, yesterday I had talked to another reporter down in Tucson who referred to, I think, J.T. Reddy and his association with Russell Pierce as a neo-Nazi, and I'm wondering whether there's enough bad stuff on the record without associating these people with Nazis. I mean, but is it – so what's the truth here?
Well, with Chris Kobach, he's currently the Secretary of State of Kansas, but he was the – he's also at the council of a group called the Immigration Law Reform Institute. So they drive a lot of the conversation about bills like State Bill 1070 and elsewhere. And they, my understanding is that he specifically wrote the legislation that was passed.
And again, to my point about the climate down there, it seems to me that there's no need for hyperbole. It's bad enough, isn't it? I mean, when you have the candidate who ran against the congresswoman inviting people to shoot M16s with him and to take her out and Sarah Palin and all this other stuff that's being discussed now, it seems that this should be a wake-up call for everybody, particularly people on the right. But now they're sort of running around, going through mental contortions to say, oh, this is all about a crazy guy, not about our politics.
Sure. It's watching the last election here in Tucson, we had two rather contentious races, Raul Grijalva against Ruth McClung, and we had the Gabrielle Giffords race as well. And they were very contentious races. It had its ugly moments, but where the people, you'd lost the sort of ability to discuss people as their issues, but instead it sort of spilled into these sort of greater demonizations. At least from my thought, I thought Gabrielle Giffords made an effort to remain above the fray there. She mostly tried to discuss what she was doing, but her opponent, Jesse Kelly, I mean, it was essentially, this woman is a tool of Barack Obama, a tool of, you know, Harry Reid, a tool of this Democratic establishment. So, I mean, you did have, you lose these people as being individuals at some times. And that's, to me at least, what's most distressing about it.
And he's running again, isn't he, this Marine Sergeant Jesse Kelly?
He was, he has an announcement that was scheduled for this forthcoming Saturday. So it's a matter of what he'll run for, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly something. I mean, he doesn't seem to be leaving the political world.
So is Dan Gibson, again, reporter for the Tucson Weekly, is there any soul-searching going on? I mean, when there's the Pima County Sheriff says we should reflect on what's happening, and he's getting jumped on by the conservative commentators, all of whom are on the defensive because he alluded to them, and Fox News tried to beat him up in an interview. So where's the reflection? Is it happening anywhere?
It seems to be. I mean, there was certainly, with any sort of event of this type of magnitude, I mean, you have that immediate grief and reflection. I mean, there were events all over town, and it seemed that you did see people from both parties, from different parts of the spectrum, coming together to mourn and to pray and to reflect on what happened. It's challenging to say what's going to happen next. I don't, with the way the legislature is, with the supermajority they have, there's no particular incentive to work with Democrats or to be moderate in any way. You have political ideologues in those positions, and it's once the grief wears off or things return to some normalcy, it's hard to imagine that there'll be some large reflection and change of course.
So What's the extent to which the rest of the nation influences? If you say there's a supermajority that Russell Pierce controls, is there any? sense that the state's getting this reputation as being, a kind of America's Third Reich, if you will. I mean, I know a lot of that rhetoric came around during SB 1070. So.
Oh, sure. It's troubling. We had an interview with last week with a Democratic legislator here, and he said his goal was to try to keep Arizona off the Daily Show. We're in that race. GQ magazine had us as the worst state in the union. It's a strange thing in that you have different cultures here. I mean, there's almost three separate sort of political mentalities. There's the people in Phoenix, and you have varying political views and challenges there. You have rural Arizona, which is generally widely conservative, and you have Tucson, which at times, you know, there's been threats, like people in Tucson will say we should secede from the state, and, you know, there is a little more of a liberal political climate down here in the city itself, although around the suburbs it goes back to being pretty conservative.
Well, Dan, I'm afraid we have such a full deck today, and I'm sorry that can we revisit this, because there's obviously a lot more to talk with, and I talked with you about, and I'm sorry we ran out of time. No. We've got to go to Mark Potok now, who I spoke with just before I came on the air, because at the present moment he's on Keith Urban on MSNBC. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'm speaking with Mark Potok, spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor of the award-winning quarterly investigative journal Intelligence Report and the Hate Watch blog. Previously, he spent almost 20 years as an award-winning reporter at newspapers including USA Today, the Dallas Times Herald, and the Miami Herald. And Mark Potok, Robert Mueller, the FBI director, has been put in charge of the investigation by President Obama, looking into the 22-year-old shooter down in Arizona, Jared Loughner, and his possible links to extremist groups. And Mueller said that would continue to be a focus of the investigation. So far, what do you know about these links? Because you know they've already become a political hot potato with conservatives and conservative talk radio and television people going out of their ways to say there's no linkage. On the other hand, there appears to be some linkage.
Well, this is what I see. I looked through, I think, virtually all of the material of this man that have been made public, and I certainly didn't see anything even suggesting a link to any particular group. There have been reports of, on Fox News reported something about a possible link, people inside DHS are supposedly saying, to an anti-black group called American Renaissance, but I do not think that's true. I've got some information that suggests that link is extremely weak at best. And in any event, in reading through all of Gerald Lee Loughner's materials, I saw nothing that related to race or anti-Semitism or even the issue of immigration. That said, I thought there were some very definite markers, that suggested he would be getting some of his ideas from the radical right. Let me say right off the bat, though, that I think when you read through his material, it is unbelievably discombobulated, and it's very, very clear that indeed the man is mentally ill or has some, real problem in his head. That said, though, there are bits and pieces, real clues, and let me just run through a few of them, if I might.
Go ahead.
He talks, for instance, about the only real currency being currency backed by gold and silver. That really, Ian, is a core idea of the anti-government patriot movement, the so-called militia movement, this concept that gold and silver are unconstitutional, they're not lawful or real money. Loughner talks about that, but in very, odd ways. It's hard to understand what he's saying, but clearly he's saying that, the currency has to be backed by gold and silver. And, this is an idea of the extreme right going back, some 70, 80 years. And, of course, you now hear those ideas even in more ostensibly centrist groups like the Tea Parties, but it's very definitely an idea of the right. More sort of arcane and strange is Loughner talks about the idea of using English grammar to control people or the people, and in fact at one point explicitly mentions the idea of the government controlling people through the use of grammar. That I feel certain. There's really only one person out there putting out this, really bizarre theory, and that is a right-wing conspiracy theorist, a man from Milwaukee by the name of David Wynn Miller, who theorizes just that the government controls us all through grammar. It's almost virtually an incomprehensible theory, and the man is really out there. But he believes things like the government enslaves you at birth by printing your name in all capital letters on your birth certificate. But if you instead use a certain combination of full colons and hyphens in your own proper name when you write it, you will break the chains of government tyranny. And what's more, you won't have to pay your taxes. So pretty good deal all around. Then Loeffner simply goes through a whole bunch of things. He talks about not being able to trust the government. The government uses mind control. A person in a video that's been attributed to him burns a U.S. flag, and so on. That, along with his reading list, seems to me to suggest this idea of kind of the individual against the state, the individual against the totalitarian, oppressive state. And I thought that was very much present in his reading list. It's an odd list. It includes, a lot of things like Animal Farm in 1984 by George Orwell, Ayn Rand's book, We the Living, which is very, explicitly about the idea of the individual versus the state. But also things like the Communist Manifesto and Mein Kampf. The idea that the Communist Manifesto is there, of course, has gotten, as you suggested, all the kind of right-wing news sites and bloggers and so on going on about how this guy is really a left-winger, which I think is quite ludicrous. I think that really he sees those books. They all have a sort of smash the state theme. So it's those sorts of things. I don't think that he was any kind of political thinker. I mean, he's incredibly incoherent. But I think he had real mental problems, but he did absorb some of these key ideas. And arguably, it's these ideas from the right that cause, he might, who's to say who a person like him might have hurt? Could have been his parents, could have been kids at an elementary school. But somehow he selected this target, and it seems to me very likely that all of the rhetoric from the right about the government being evil essentially may have had something to do with who he targeted.
Again, I'm speaking with Mark Potok of the Southern Poverty Law Center, and we're trying to get an understanding of the very disturbed mind of the assassin or attempted assassin in terms of the shooting the congresswoman in Tucson, Arizona, the 22-year-old Jared Loeffner, who I believe shouted out the names of the people before he shot them. I think that's been pretty much established. So, and he had some interaction with her. So there's no question he targeted her. I think that's fairly established. There is, of course, the debate that I'm discussing here with Mark Potok about what influenced this person. And it one of the things though, that seems to be absurd about the mental gymnastics that a lot of right-wing talk people and Fox and others are going through to dissociate themselves from this guy suggests that these things I don't think are mutually exclusive. He's a crazy guy who was acting alone, and you can't pin any kind of ideology on him because he's too nutty. But what you can make clear, and I think what is clear, is the political environment down there in Tucson and in Arizona, in the state itself, is extremely volatile, extremely toxic, extremely dominated by the right wing. And you have the ability that anybody, including a nutcase like this guy, can get a concealed weapon that fires an awful lot of bullets very fast. In fact, you can carry concealed weapons into bars, which seems extraordinary to me. But these are the facts. Now, when you mentioned the DHS memo that Fox News had heard about or got hold of, my understanding was that was a leak about the use of his computer, as opposed to, because every computer has a history, as opposed to the idea that he was linked to this American Renaissance racist group. They, of course, have denied, saying he doesn't have any, we have no record of him joining us. The internet is such that you don't have to join groups to be influenced by them. You can just visit their pages, surely.
Sure. I think what it actually has to do with was a particular event that he may have noticed on the American Renaissance website. I really can't talk about it because this is essentially confidential information. But I just think, the idea that he was somehow close to American Renaissance is not supported by what I know. But and I don't pretend to have, any kind of absolute knowledge of this.
What about the business that he talks about in terms of the linkage that can be made with this 62-year-old former tool and die welder from Milwaukee, David Wynn Miller, who has this peculiar obsession with language and grammar and has come up with these mathematical formula, which clearly that is what the YouTube video of Loftner's is all about, if you watch it. Now, one of the reporters down there in Tucson I spoke with yesterday said that there was a link to some of this obsession with grammar and people who can't speak English in terms of the environment down there, this anti-Hispanic Latino environment as a result of SB 1070. Do you give that any credence?
Well, I haven't seen any language like that, so I don't know what the reporter you spoke to, you know, had in mind in terms of that. I mean, he talked about grammar. He didn't talk about people with, you know, non-English accents, at least nothing that I've seen. But, you know, look, as a general matter, I think, you know, you're essentially right. And you know, what's been going on today, I've been on a lot of radio shows today, and just as you suggested at the beginning of the program, I mean, there is this kind of pushback from the political right, largely from the right wing of the Republican Party. You know, they feel that they're being unfairly demonized and so on. And, you know, what they're saying, aside from making these silly arguments that this guy was sort of a left-winger, is they're essentially suggesting that there's an equivalency, right? That it's, you know, Olbermann is the same as Glenn Beck. You know, that there are you know, there's irrational and you know, vitriolic language from left and right and so on. And I think that is a very, very shaded characterization of what's objectively happened out there. I mean, I think it's perfectly obvious. Sure, I mean, I can find you, you know, an anarchist in San Francisco who said, you know, Bush should be killed or is a Nazi or something like that. But the difference is that the noise from the political right over the last several years has been, you know, coming from Congress people. It's been coming from people with television shows that reach 2 million individuals every night. It's been coming from people like, you know, Rush Limbaugh with his gigantic audience, or Michael Savage, you know, his 8 million radio listeners every week. So it seems to me very different, and, you know, the vitriol from the right, you know, vastly, it seems to me, outdistances what we've heard from the left, what there is of a sort of hard left out there. So I just don't see it, and I think it's a way, you know, I mean, what we hear now is kind of conservatives saying, you know, words don't have any consequence. It's irrelevant, right? I mean, the whole political conversation, the fact, what the sheriff of Pima County said about, you know, Arizona being the mecca of prejudice and bigotry, it's all baloney. It's completely irrelevant. It has no relationship to this guy because he was mentally ill. And it just seems to me that that's false. You know, very typically in the kinds of people we look at, you know, it will be a person who is unstable in one way or another mentally who's the first to act on this kind of propaganda. Not always. You know, I would not characterize Timothy McVeigh as mentally ill. I think he was, you know, a very sort of determined and rather evil, you know, kind of political soldier, a genuine terrorist. But, you know, think back a year ago, but just about this time last year, last February, a man named Joseph Stack flew his private airplane into an IRS building in Austin and killed himself and also an IRS employee. That guy, too, you know, had these meandering writings. He sounded quite wacky. He was angry at very many things in his life. But there was a theme that ran through all of his writings, and that was, the government is evil, and in particular, the federal government has no right to tax us. You know, in his case, it turned out he'd been to a few radical tax protest seminars and so on. But, you know, the point is not that the people who carry these acts out aren't, you know, don't have mental problems. The point is that something out there in the environment is helping them to focus their rage on very particular targets.
Well, Mark Potok, it seems that some of the mental gymnastics that Sarah Palin and others are going through to dissociate themselves from this fellow miss the point, in as much as, not one, the victim, Congressman Gifford's own father, when asked, did your daughter have any enemies? He said, yes, the whole Tea Party. And two, the Congresswoman herself, back in March, went on television.
Right.
After her office was vandalized and bricks were thrown through the window and her other office in another part of her district was shot up, she went out of her way to castigate Sarah Palin for putting this target on her to have her knocked off in the election, which almost happened. And as we know, the person that Sarah Palin supported, the Tea Party candidate, Jesse Kelly, offered up at his fundraisers, you could shoot a fully loaded M16 with him. So these are more than atmospherics. These are facts.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, I think it's very interesting that now, you know, some on the right are saying, well, look, you know, Sarah Palin, she's so careful and so responsible. She, you know, today or yesterday scrubbed her site of those crosshairs over the various districts, including Representative Gifford's district. Well, you know, as you point out, the Congresswoman was on national television last March, I think is sounding very reasonable, and saying that those crosshairs specifically were the kinds of things that put people in danger. And, you know, we heard nothing from the Palin camp. They didn't take those crosshairs down then. Now that we've got a woman in a hospital with, a bullet through her brain, clinging to life, apparently Palin and her people feel that it's kind of bad press to have those things left up on their website, and so down they come. But, you know, at the time when the representative really criticized this, but without calling Palin ugly names, but I think in a very rational, straight-ahead way, said this was bad news, you know, there was no response from the Palin camp.
And, of course, even in that interview itself, NBC's political White House reporter Chuck Todd took the position to Congressman Giffords, saying, well, you know, you can't really associate the people throwing the brick through your window with Sarah Palin. So he was taking the kind of line that a lot of reporters are taking now in sort of defending, particularly on Fox. As you know, there was a pretty contentious interview on Fox with the Pima County Sheriff where they tried to back him into a corner and suggest that he was being irresponsible for saying what he was saying. So even back then, this apologist position was being expressed. And, of course, the Congresswoman did not accept that. She said, no, I really believe that Sarah Palin is responsible for stirring up this stuff.
Well, and she's quite right. I mean, I don't know about Sarah Palin, but, I mean, if you remember what sparked all of that brick throwing, it was a particular man in Alabama, furious about the health care vote, saying, throw bricks today through Democratic representatives and Democratic Party headquarters offices through their windows. So, you know, in fact, the attacks occurred around the country. And then, you know, I'm sure you remember that in one case, a propane gas line to a congressman's brother's home, who the assailant apparently thought was the congressman's home, was cut. I mean, you know, it sounded an awful lot like an attempted murder. I mean, the man had three children in the house. Mm.
So, well, just in closing, Mark, do you think that we're running out of time? Do you think that there's going to be an intelligence response to this on the part of the Congress, or are the Republicans in the Congress going to arm themselves because they feel they have to be defended? I mean, where is this going? Because so far the debate has not been following this attempted assassination, has not been in any way illuminating or encouraging.
Yeah, I think it's very much up in the air. I mean, I think, you know, what we've seen today in particular, as this kind of news story play out, is it being played completely as the right wing pushing back. It's not us. It has nothing to do with us. These are evil left wingers or evil Democrats trying to pin this one on us unfairly. You know, of course, we've heard people like John Boehner and the president as well, you know, making calls for people to calm down and so on. And that seems right, but whether that's going to get any traction at all, I think is very much in question because, you know, in talking about, say, the bricks that were thrown through people's windows last spring, there were calls back then, weak ones, I have to say, from certain leaders in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party as well, for calming things down, but they really didn't. The same kind of vitriol was out there. And, of course, the sheriff of Pima County is right that Arizona is, if not the mecca, it is certainly one of the hot spots in this country. I mean, the immigration debate down there has raised the political temperature to a point that I think it's not entirely surprising to see this kind of violence.
I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Mark Potok.
And thank you.
Bye-bye. And hello again, I'm Ian Masters, just speaking there with Mark Potok, a spokesman for the Southern Poverty Law Center and editor of the award-winning quarterly investigative journal Intelligence Report and the Hate Watch blog. Previously, he spent almost 20 years as an award-winning reporter at newspapers including USA Today, the Dallas Time-Herald, and the Miami Herald. Let's take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with a foreign policy expert about how can a gun-crazed society lead the world. Welcome back to Background Briefing. I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who is president and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He is the author of Running the World, the Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, the Global Elite and the World They Are Making. He also writes for Foreign Policy magazine, where he just published his article, How Can a Gun-Crazed Society Lead the World? So let me pose that question to you, David.
Well, I think since the United States has been leading the world for quite some time, clearly it's possible for a gun-crazed society to lead the world because we are clearly a gun-crazed society. However, it hinders us in our ability to lead the world because it casts a shadow over who we are. It casts a shadow over national character. And you can think about it in a purely practical sense. For example, next week, the president of China is coming to the United States. One of the issues the United States has with China is human rights. And inevitably, when the United States raises these issues with the Chinese, they seek areas to find pushback. And when you have, mass attacks in the streets, as we've just had tragically this past weekend, they point to that. And other people who sort of see the United States offering our vision of how the world should work seek to find things to criticize. And when there are such overt flaws, it undermines our ability to advance our views.
So do you think that when an American president encounters that argument with his Chinese counterpart, would it be possible for the American president to say, well, gun violence in this country is actually an extension of our freedom?
Well, I think it's possible to say that, and certainly there have been a lot of people in the United States in the course of the past 48 hours who pointed it out, because naturally, inevitably, when these things happen, people start asking questions about our liberal gun laws and whether they should be reconsidered. And even the father of the poor girl who was tragically killed there said this is, sort of the price we pay for the freedoms that we have. So I'm not saying that there aren't rejoinders. What I am saying, though, is if one seeks to offer an example of moral leadership, if one seeks to offer an example of a society that's constantly able to perfect itself, and yet that society leads the world in civilian gun ownership, that we own 35% to 50% of all the civilian-owned guns on the planet. There are 90 guns in the United States for every 100 people. That raises some questions. And we as a society ought to be looking inward and saying, do we like what this says about us? Do we like this aspect of our society? Is this time for an evolution away from this? What could we do that's consistent with our views of freedom that could move us into a kind of a less violent, less armed place as a society?
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who has just written an article for Foreign Policy magazine called How Can a Gun-Crazed Society Lead the World? Of course, the freedom argument, which I was posing with some irony, David Rothkopf, comes down in many ways to an interpretation of the Second Amendment, which the Supreme Court just recently reinterpreted after decades of settled law, where the predicate to the Second Amendment, which says a well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Now, prior to that, the predicate of the well-regulated militia did allow the government some leeway to regulate guns, but the Supreme Court turned that on its head and took the second part of it, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed, overturning the D.C. gun law. So that's where we're at. In Arizona, this disturbed individual was able to buy a Glock with apparently some magazines that held a lot of bullets and go on this spree, and he carried it as a concealed weapon without any background check.
Well, look, and that, I mean, the law is deranged as the guy who abused the opportunity. The Supreme Court has clearly embraced a political position on this, and one that's ironically at odds with the kind of strict constructionist views that many of the right-wing judges who supported that decision allegedly have, right? Because that first part of that sentence is extremely significant, and if it weren't significant, it wouldn't have been in the Constitution. And it is explaining the reason why people have a right to guns, and that is for a militia. But we don't have militias. We've long since passed being a society that has militias, and so the predicate no longer actually provides the justification that it did once, and that's the kind of thing that should lead people to reinterpret or even to amend the Constitution, because it's led to, you know, the kind of abuse and kind of gun mania that is so destructive in the United States. You know, 140,000 people have died since 9/11 as a result of gun violence in the United States. That's many, many, many times the number of people killed in terrorist attacks or killed in the wars that we're involved in to fight off terrorism. It's a much greater danger to the security of the United States. And yet we, you know, return to these convoluted, self-serving debates about this right, which actually doesn't exist in the Constitution as it is construed by the most rabid of the pro-gun crowd.
So, David Rothkopf, as a student of American foreign policy, how would you defend this, or how would you explain the right-wing embrace of guns in this country to people abroad who, as you know, in Europe and other countries, they're absolutely mystified?
Well, I mean, I don't think I'd defend it.
I might explain
it by saying, you know, that there is a long historical precedent here in it, and it has come down over time to be associated with a kind of the American spirit, independence, the strength that accrues to the individual in our society, and as often happens with things like that over time, it's become a little, you know, quasi-theological, and we've lost the ability to have a rational discussion about this issue. I mean, you know, take assault weapons, you know, where people were sitting there saying, oh, no, you can't infringe on people's right to, you know, have an AK-47, you know, so what? So they can hunt squirrels with it? I mean, there is no right to have an AK-47, and if there is a right to have an AK-47, it ought to go the same way as, you know, the Constitution's prescription for having only white males be able to vote. Time and technology have changed the nature of weapons. They've changed the nature of society, and the Constitution is designed to keep up with those changes if only the people would.
But I don't understand. There has to be a cultural explanation for why, first of all, in politics in this country, in many ways, the right wing have usurped or grabbed the political high ground. They've effectively confiscated the Bible and appropriated the Constitution. And we are always, the images are always of John Wayne and Ronald Reagan, and tall in the saddle. They're all of these kind of Western cowboy kind of images, and liberals are painted as wimps, and I don't understand why guns are associated with strength and manliness, because frankly, only a coward pulls a gun in a fight.
Well, you know, there are Westerns for everybody, and you know, in High Noon, the hero doesn't use the gun, at least until the very end. There, you know, the West didn't become the prosperous West from which you broadcast until the law took the upper hand over those who took the law into their own hands, and you know, that gun culture was subdued to some extent. I agree with you. I think that, you know, the right has taken the high ground, or, you know, not the high ground, but the more advantageous ground on some of these things, in part because the more liberal elements of society stay on the defensive and they're afraid to be assertive here. And you know, this is clearly an issue where the Constitution is being twisted, where the notion of individual rights is being extended to the point that it does damage to community rights of a grievous sort, and it needs to be fixed. And you're right. They seize the Bible too, and they, you know, somehow say that there's some, you know, connection between religion and the founding fathers that not only didn't exist, but actually is the opposite of what existed, and that most of the founding fathers, including Washington and Jefferson and others, were deists who did not want to introduce religion, and in fact had seen the damage of the past couple of hundred years of European history that happens when there is too much religion in society. So they are offering not history, but a polemicized version of history that's doing real damage, and it's time for a kind of counterbalancing strong arguments from those who would like to see the kind of improvement and reinvention of American society that the Constitution was actually created to ensure.
Again, I'm speaking with David Rothkopf, who has just written an article for Foreign Policy magazine called How Can a Gun-Crazed Society Lead the World? And in your article, David, you call for changing the tenor of our political discourse in the United States, which is replete with venom-tongued and reckless political extremism and hate-mongering, which have increased over the recent years. In terms of the congresswoman who was shot a couple of days ago and who remains in critical condition, her father, when asked, does your daughter have any enemies, he said, yes, the whole Tea Party. And she ran against a Tea Party candidate who Sarah Palin had endorsed and put a target on a map of her district, targeting it and her for removal. These are the exact words. And the Tea Party candidate, who Gabrielle Giffords narrowly defeated in this last election, his name is Jesse Kelly. A part of his campaign against the congresswoman was, you can join me and donate to my campaign and join me in shooting a fully loaded M16. Do you have any comments on this? It all seems so extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, but, you know, it's nauseating. And the reality is that the tenor of the debate in the United States has become uncivil, violent, and extreme. And one can only hope that an event like this actually causes an adjustment. Clearly, the guy who was involved in this shooting didn't have anything like a political agenda. But the culture of hatred, the language of violence, does color the behavior of individuals and, in fact, invites abuses from those who are unhinged or unable to sort of understand, you know, what's political rhetoric and what's advice. We need a change. I'm hopeful. You know, Katrina as a hurricane was not necessarily connected to climate change, but it produced a change in the way the United States viewed that issue. And, you know, sometimes history doesn't move like a timeline. It's more like a billiards game. And, you know, an event ricochets off something and produces another reaction. This was not an extremist act, but it may change our view towards extremist dialogue. And it's hard to imagine, you know, Sharon Engel talking about Second Amendment political solutions today after this tragedy. It's hard to imagine Sarah Palin putting gun targets on congressional districts after this. And one hopes that the revulsion at the venomous language that is sort of called into focus by an event like this may produce some kind of modulation in this debate in the United States and may produce pushback from those who would abuse and overstate and fire up people through this kind of lowest common denominator, really grotesque approaches.
Well, just in closing, David Rothkopf, in the Constitution or in the preamble, it mentions a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. And foreign policy, of course, would involve a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. And it's a question of how much the average American cares about the rest of the world, what they think, but obviously it's important for those who conduct foreign policy, and that's in many ways, I take it, why you wrote this article. The respect for the U.S. has taken some terrible hits recently, as you know, during the Bush administration. They still have not been held accountable for torture, which has had really malignant and far-reaching effects on our foreign policy, simply because all the dictators in the world now say, well, we can go ahead and torture because you, the Americans, do it. So we've lost the moral high ground there. You saying that when the president meets with the Chinese leader in the next couple of weeks, he's been undercut in his arguments about human rights because of these shootings. And just in closing, the irony is that when these congresswoman's window was smashed back in March, when she was threatened and another one of her officers in Arizona was shot at, it was because of her vote on the health care bill. And my understanding is that one of the measures of a civilized and compassionate society is the extent to which it takes care of its own citizens and their health. So we seem to be really kind of losing sight as a society and a country of the good opinions of mankind.
I totally agree with you. I believe that the past 10 years have been extremely damaging to the United States and have revealed really deep flaws in the U.S. national character. Any society would have been shocked by 9/11. But a just society with the proper set of values would not then have resorted to torture, the violation of international law, and the things that we did in the wake of that, including Abu Ghraib and a host of other instances. In the same way, you know, we self-righteously, you know, twist our own constitution in a way that allows deranged individuals to get a hold of advanced weapons of destruction, you know, of individual destruction, and use them. And the result is that the United States' moral standing in the world, our ability to lead, is tarnished in a way that's going to take years and years to address. But we're not going to change simply because the rest of the world may look down on us. The only way we're going to change is if we look within ourselves and ask, is this the kind of society that we want to be? Is it a society that embraces torture? Is it a society that can conduct Abu Ghraib? Is it a society that violates international law? Is it a society that's the most weaponized civil society in the world? Or do we want to be something different? And I think most Americans at some level do want to be something different. And the only thing we can hope is that tragic events like these catalyze the change that lead us to a better place.
I thank you for joining us here today on Background Briefing, David Rothkopf.
Thanks a lot.
And again, David Rothkopf is President and CEO of Garton Rothkopf and a visiting scholar at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's the author of Running the World, The Inside Story of the National Security Council and the Architects of American Power, and Superclass, The Global Elite and the World They Are Making. He also writes for Foreign Policy magazine, which has just published his article, How Can a Gun-Crazed Society Lead the World? I thank producer Spencer Downing, engineer Ray Paliers. I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with Background Briefing. Bye. Sing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and the land here under free. One time, one night.